Did you know that 69% of people profess to be bad at writing love letters? But among those who filter their tap water, more than 80% say they can't write a good love note.
That's just one of more than 1,100 weird and surprising and seemingly random correlations from the website correlated.org.
If you've ever wondered about the connections between seemingly unrelated things, like whether people who like marshmallows in their hot chocolate also prefer sprinkles on their ice cream cones, and whether apartment dwellers are more or less likely to read comic books, you're about to find the answers.
With us now is Sean Gallagher. He's founder of the website correlated.org. His new book is Correlated, Surprising Correlations Between Seemingly Unrelated Things. Sean, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me.
So where did you get the idea to start correlating weird, random things?
Well, I've always sort of had this idea that maybe there might be these hidden correlations between things that we wouldn't think to associate with one another. And I thought to myself, you know, if nobody's ever going to dig into these things, because you just don't know what's going to correlate with what, maybe we could just start collecting the data and see what happens. So sort of as a joke or a tongue-in-cheek sort of project, I started the website correlated.org. And the way it works is every day there's a new poll question posted. And people come in and they give their responses to the daily poll question. And at the end of the day, I take all of those responses and I compare them to the responses of all previous poll questions. And I find the two that have the strongest correlation, and I post a little statistic about it on the website. And all the material from the book Correlated, comes from that data set. It's a massive data set that I've collected over the past 3 years. And, you know, not only even people who have been with the website since day one, they're going to find plenty of new stuff in the book, because the way I did it with the book is, instead of comparing each poll question to everything that came before it, I had the ability to compare it not only to what came before it, but what came after. So it's all new data crunching, and I've generated a whole bunch of really weird and interesting statistics.
And there may be statisticians out there sharpening their statistics knives. You're not presenting this as hard science, but as interesting tidbits and kind of conversation starters. Am I right?
That's right. Yeah, I think the average person with a background in statistics is either going to love it or hate it. If they love it, they're in on. If they love it, they're in on the joke. They understand that this isn't going to stand up to scientific scrutiny. If they hate it, they're just going to hate it because it's not sound science. But that's not what it's intended to be. Just what you said, it's conversation starters. It's the sort of thing where you can leave on a coffee table and, you know, have some friends over and talk about some of these strange statistics. Maybe talk about, you know, you might take a look at a statistic like 42% of people carry around a pocket knife, but among those who have broken a bone, 52% carry around a pocket knife. And you might ask, well, why is that? Obviously, not every correlation has anything to do with causation, but some correlations do. So this is a way to start a conversation about what might be going on in the background to explain the correlation.
So here's one. I flipped through the book and pulled out some that I liked. Chicken pox. So among everybody who went on your survey, 39% of people say they have an above average libido. But for those who haven't had chicken pox, 69% say they have an above average libido. Well, that sets you to thinking a little bit about the long term impact of chicken pox, maybe.
Right. And I have no idea whether chicken pox actually affects the libido, but it is kind of fun to think about what if it did, you know, what could explain all of this. And it's led to a lot of interesting conversations just as I've been running the site with people coming up with different possibilities and different explanations.
And trying to come up with, yeah, pet theories for why that correlation might be.
Exactly.
So what are some that have struck you as the most surprising or weirdest correlations you've come across?
I've had a bit of time to think about that over the past 3 years, and there's one that I've always kind of chuckled about. I did a poll pretty early on with the website about people's opinions about breast implants, whether they, you know, have positive feelings about them or negative. And one that I got a kick out of was that people who have run a marathon or are interested in running one are more likely than the average person to have a positive opinion about breast implants. So I don't know what's going on in these runners' heads, but it certainly seems, if you believe the data, that they have a wider open mind than the average person.
Yeah, and then you start thinking, okay, is there something about actually running marathons that changes your mind, makes you think a different way, or is there something inherent that leads you to both run a marathon and think in that different way?
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's all sorts of different explanations about why these correlations could be so. One of the things that I talk about in a sidebar in the book is the concept of a confounding variable. Mm. And that's sort of a hidden cause of both things. Like you were saying, it's one cause of both attributes in the correlation. And one of the simplest examples of a confounding variable is one statistic that's often trotted out to show how absurd correlations can be is that in the summertime, both incidents of drowning and ice cream sales rise. Now, obviously, ice cream sales don't cause drownings. Drownings don't cause ice cream sales. The confounding variable is that it's hot out and people are more likely to eat ice cream and more likely to go swimming when the weather rises. So that's just one way to explain what's going on behind the scenes with this data. But there's all sorts of different possibilities. Some of the correlations have, you can make a stronger case for causation than others.
Well, here's another weird one that maybe I can explain, or maybe you can. In general, 29% of people like Robin Williams better when he's in a serious role than in a funny role. So Robin Williams, serious, better, 29% of people think that. But for people who don't enjoy popping bubble wrap, that goes up to 50%. Those bubble wrap non-poppers are more likely to like serious Robin Williams. That one makes sense to me. They're, you know, they approach the world more seriously. Bubble wrap has a function. I take that function seriously, and when I want to see Mork in serious roles, not cracking wise. That one kind of adds up, don't you think?
I agree completely with that analysis, and I think just sticking with that one particular statistic. I think that over time, the Robin Williams thing has popped up with several different poll questions being highly correlated. And in almost all of them, it's exactly as you say. It seems like people who just take life more seriously are more likely to prefer Robin Williams in dramatic roles. And he's very good at both. But yeah, they're more likely to prefer him in the more serious stuff.
We're talking about the surprising correlations between seemingly unrelated human behaviors with Sean Gallagher. He's the founder of the website correlated.org. His new book is called Correlated.
And we want to hear from you. Do you have a question for our guests, maybe about how these statistics come about and how to make use of them in everyday life if you can? Our number, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org.
And would you rather see Robin Williams in a serious movie or a comedy? And does that fact tell us something about you? 800-642-1234 is the number.
We're talking about the strange connections between seemingly unrelated things with Sean Gallagher, founder of the website correlated.org and author of the book Correlated, Surprising Correlations Between Seemingly Unrelated Things.
And you can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Do you do the surveys at correlated.org? Why? Do you have fun doing those? Have you checked them out online? And do you have a question about these correlations, maybe about the statistics behind them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page where we put a link to correlated.org. Sean, it's a big data era. A lot of the big companies, your Facebooks, Target, everybody's trying to collect lots of data. You've got lots of data. Are marketers banging down your door trying to get their hands on what you're collecting there?
No, the type of data that I collect is probably not going to be too useful to those online marketers. I actually, my day job, I work as a software programmer for one of those companies that uses big data in more rigorous ways. So I have a little bit of experience working with that kind of stuff, but there are a couple of problems with my data set from an online marketer's perspective. So for instance, the people who respond to my polls are self-selected, and that can introduce a selection bias. People who are, for instance, the audience skews young, are technologically savvy. And so if you're working for a traditional retailer where the demographic is older, not very tech savvy, the data that I get is not really going to be very useful to you. But it is a great way to find out both the strengths and the limitations of big data.
Well, I want to get back to some of these surprising correlations. Here's one I thought was interesting. 56% of us, a little more than half, don't have a strong preference for a particular Monopoly game piece. I like the Battleship, but, you know, Top Hat I can live with, the dog maybe. But among people who floss regularly, 71% don't care which Monopoly piece they get. Explain that one if you dare, Sean.
I do have a hypothesis about that, and it's that people who floss regularly are sort of like the Robin Williams serious people. They pay attention to detail. They maybe aren't very don't really have much of a funny bone, and I just don't see those types of people being as likely to be Monopoly enthusiasts. So they probably don't care what piece they get. That's my hypothesis, but I really, I understand that there's so many different ways that you can explain
it. Oh, sure. Sure. No, I think the fun part is coming up with the explanation. I mean, this could be a party game. Here's another good correlation, professional wrestling. So 47% of people say acquaintances would describe them as soft-spoken. So about half of us say, yeah, my friends say I'm soft-spoken. But for people who like professional wrestling, only about a quarter say acquaintances would describe them as soft-spoken. That's kind of easy to explain, I would think. If we've learned to talk from our favorite professional wrestlers, that would make sense, Sean, I think.
Right, and I've watched plenty of professional wrestling, and the people you get out in the crowds are not quiet people.
Right. Okay, so that's an easy one. That adds up pretty well. Are there any that have just really baffled you, like being, you know, again, understanding that it's not scientific statistics, but one that really seemed counterintuitive to you?
There have been a few, not necessarily counterintuitive, but I've just been kind of at a loss to explain it. One of them that I feature in the book is that people who cut the fabric tags off of their clothing are more likely than the average person to have ridden on a motorcycle. And I guess I would have thought that it would be the reverse. People who are out riding on motorcycles are tough people who, you know, not a lot bothers them. And I would think that they would be less likely to worry about a little tiny fabric tag. But maybe that is their Achilles heel. Maybe just that tiny little fabric tag is almost like the princess and the pea, where, you know, it's just that one little nagging thing that gets to you.
Ruins you on a long ride. Or maybe it's aerodynamics. That little tag flapping in the breeze, yeah. Well, here's, speaking of tough people, 67% of people, 2 in 3, know how to tie a necktie. Among those who have been in a fist fight, 82% know how to tie a necktie. Now, that seemed counterintuitive to me at first. You think, you know, people who wear ties are not getting in fights. But is this a gender thing, maybe?
I think it's a gender thing. I think people who I think men are more likely to both know how to tie a tie and to get into fistfights.
So how often do you see a correlation? You've been doing this for a long time that really describes you, Sean. Like, yep, that fits me.
Well, I have the advantage of being able to choose the poll questions that get posted. So sometimes I will select a poll question that I really want to answer. Actually, the poll question that's up on the website right now asks whether people are a fan of the band Paramore. I've heard their stuff on the radio lately, and I thought it was pretty good. So I wanted to answer yes to that question and see what it might say about me. Because really, I'm just as in the dark as everybody else until I actually crunch the data and find out what the correlations are.
It's a voyage of self-discovery. Sean, if people are listening and want to play at home, can anybody go to correlated.org and start taking polls, or is this invitation only?
Oh, no. Anybody can go. Anybody can answer the poll question. Now, the important thing for how we generate the data is to be able to track people's responses over time to make correlations. So to see what they said yesterday and see how it compares to what they said today. So what generally happens is when you answer the first poll question, you'll be prompted to register with just an email address, and that'll allow us to track the responses over time. You can also sign up to get a daily email newsletter with the results of the previous day's poll question. So even if you don't visit the website, you can just get this daily results email and stay in the loop.
Sean, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thanks for your time.
That's Sean Gallagher. He's the founder of the website correlated.org. We've got a link on the Central Time Facebook page if you want to start filling out the polls. His new book is Correlated: Surprising Correlations Between Seemingly Unrelated Things. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, yesterday evening saw the results of some big primaries around the country. USA Today politics editor Paul Singer joins us for our weekly look at Congress.
First, two big rulings out of the Supreme Court today. One case pitted broadcasters against an internet startup looking to shake up the way Americans watch television. In a 6-3 decision, the court ruled that the company Aereo was violating copyright on the various networks programs.
The court also unanimously ruled that police and law enforcement need a warrant to search a suspect's cell phone upon arrest, saying the quality and quantity of data on today's phones is protected under the Constitution.
Here to discuss those rulings is Jess Braven, Supreme Court correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Jess, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's start with that first case we mentioned, the internet startup company Aereo. What was Aereo doing that got them in legal limbo to begin with?
Well, Aereo offered a service that allowed subscribers to get the content of broadcast television onto their home screens, and it did so in a way that was, you might say, too clever by half. It sought to get around the court's rulings on copyright protection by essentially leasing to each subscriber his own tiny antenna, which would be used to pull the broadcast signal off the air, and then it would be held on a DVR, digital video recorder type device, central device that the subscriber could watch at any time. And the question was, were they simply a device that each individual subscriber was using, much like anyone can record, off the air broadcasts at home? Or were they actually a retransmission service, like a cable company that was actually collecting the signals and retransmitting them to an audience, which would infringe under copyright? And the Supreme Court, by 6-3 vote, said it was the latter case, that Aereo was not just a device people were using, much like they could at home if they put an antenna on the roof and connected their own DVR, but rather they were essentially pirating broadcasts and rebroadcasting them themselves.
And that was the argument of the major broadcasters and PBS saying, hey, you are packaging our stuff as your own and making money off of it, was their core argument. And the majority, it sounds like, agreed with that case?
That's right. The majority opinion by Justice Stephen Breyer said that this system or this service looks much like a cable television service, even though it uses a different type of technology. The result is really the same, and we have held before that it's understood that cable companies need to pay the broadcast networks for retransmitting their content. So does Aereo. Three justices, in a dissent by Justice Antonin Scalia, said that really was not so, and they said that they essentially said Aereo had correctly read the precedents and had devised a system that avoided those copyright problems. So the court, two fairly thoughtful opinions. The Supreme Court reversing a lower court that had ruled for Aereo. So it definitely was a matter that has stirred up some controversy in the judiciary.
The majority was what's viewed as the traditionally liberal four justices, plus the swing Justice Kennedy, plus the Chief Justice Roberts, and then three conservatives in the minority opinion you just mentioned. Was this seen somehow as a partisan split kind of issue, or did it just happen to shake out that way?
I think it just shook out that way. I mean, most of the cases at the Supreme Court do not come down to a very clear conservative liberal divide. This case pitted two business interests against each other. I don't think it really can be seen as a reflection of tremendous ideological differences. I think it's rather a question of how different members of the court approached interpretation of federal statutes. So I don't think we can mark this one up to the court's ideological divide. We may have to wait for Thursday or Monday to see cases that trigger that stereotype.
Well, the other big ruling today was definitely not along that divide. It was a unanimous decision on police searches of mobile devices. So if you are arrested, the question is, when the police are searching items in your possession, can they search everything that you're accessing through your smartphone or tablet? So talk through what the unanimous decision said.
Well, sure. The Fourth Amendment bars unreasonable searches and seizures generally requires that authorities obtain a search warrant from a magistrate. They have to demonstrate what's called probable cause to suspect there's going to be stuff they're going to find that will be irrelevant to a criminal investigation. But there are exceptions to that, and the Supreme Court has found a number, mainly based on what might be called pragmatic considerations in the field. And one of those is called the search incident to arrest. Police have been able to go through a suspect's pockets or things that a suspect could reach when he or she is arrested, and has been justified by a need to protect officers from hidden weapons and also to prevent suspects from destroying evidence before it can be seized by the authorities. Because the courts have liked to give police bright line rules where they don't have to make these sort of hair splitting decisions on the scene, police have interpreted that to mean that, well, we can also go through a cell phone and what's inside it, just like we can go through a billfold or a wallet or an address book or a diary if we find that in somebody's pocket when they are arrested. But appeals courts have reached varying conclusions. Some have said that's right. There's no way to distinguish a cell phone from anything else you find in someone's pocket, while other courts have said there are plenty of reasons why a modern smartphone is nothing like a book of matches or something else you could find in someone's pocket.
And so the Supreme Court said this is the cell phone's a qualitatively different thing. It's not a really big notebook. It is something different.
That's right, because they said that, one, quantitatively, it is vastly different that people do not, what you might have in a diary or an address book is not like the kind of information you would have in a cell phone where you have essentially everyone you've ever called, every letter you've ever written, every photograph you've ever taken, all your bank statements, everything about you is carried around in this device in a way that's unlike any prior type of writing medium before. It also has things that have no analog at all, like internet searches and so on, which there would be nothing equivalent to that in the analog world. And it's really it's a very significant opinion because it is filled with examples rebutting every argument that law enforcement made, completely agreeing with the defendants in the cases that were on appeal at the Supreme Court. Essentially, I would say that the clearest signal that the Supreme Court is very engaged with the impact of technology on privacy rights and core constitutional rights, and will be looking very carefully at how the government uses its remarkable ability now to look at people's private lives in relation to the Bill of Rights.
Are there any tea leaves here that might say if a future case like this, but instead of police searching my cell phone, it's the NSA searching my internet records, say?
Well,
is there a tea leave there?
Well, we can certainly say that the court is aware of these issues, and you know the NSA case, for instance, or the NSA program is based on some precedents from 1979 is a key precedent in which it's based on when the way that people communicated and what they communicated was very different, and this should be a warning signal to I would say legal counsel and federal and local governments who, when they are advising law enforcement or intelligence agencies about what's permissible and what's not, to simply blindly rely on old precedents that dealt with a very different world might not be wise. I mean, those might be right, those might be wrong. We don't know what the court will do in the future. But I would say just reflexively saying, well, we could do it when we were, talking through, switchboards and Mad Men era rotary telephones would automatically apply to cell phones and smartphones and emails and texting and everything else that goes on now, I think that would probably not be a wise move for those counsel.
We'll leave it there. Jess, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure.
That's Jess Braven. He's Supreme Court correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. It's time for our weekly update on news from Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. Results are in from yesterday's round of primaries. Establishment Republicans held their ground in Mississippi with a win from Thad Cochran.
Also in the headlines, Speaker of the House John Boehner is suing President Obama for overstepping his boundaries on executive actions. Paul Singer joins us every week at this time. Welcome, Paul.
How are you doing?
Doing pretty good. Well, we've been watching over these past weeks the needle on the GOP establishment versus Tea Party this primary season. What does the latest round tell us?
Well, I mean, it looks like we are back in the GOP establishment having the upper hand. We were all set back on our heels on that theory a couple of weeks ago when House Majority Leader Eric Cantor lost his primary in a shocker to a Tea Party challenger. Although I will say in fairness that particular race was kind of an outlier. The Tea Party challenger had no major Tea Party backing at all. I think part of the issue here is that people just didn't like Eric Cantor very much, sadly. But anyway, at the moment, you know, this week, the establishment has done better. In Mississippi, Thad Cochran managed to survive a runoff against a Tea Party challenger named Chris McDaniel. McDaniel gave a very disgruntled, non-concession speech last night, very close in this runoff, just a few thousand votes separating them. And McDaniel's argument basically is that Cochran only won by getting Democrats and black voters and others who traditionally would not vote in Republican primaries to come out and rescue him.
Right. That's an interesting angle on this one. What happened there? How does a Republican get Democrats to vote for him?
Well, a Republican gets Democrats out to vote for him by pointing at the other Republican and saying, basically, that guy's crazy. You don't want him to be your senator. And you've known me for 30 years. You like me better.
And Mississippi law allows this.
Yeah. As long as you didn't vote in the Democratic primary, you were still allowed to cross over and vote in the Republican runoff. And because, again, you know, 3 weeks ago, McDaniel managed to deny Cochran an actual outright victory. They were neck and neck, and so they had to have a runoff. I think the person who's going to be most angry about this is Travis Childers, who's the Democratic congressman who's running as a Democrat in the Senate race, who is probably turning to his Democratic pals and saying, you big dopes, why did you turn out for Cochran, I'm going to have a much harder time beating him. McDaniel is maybe beatable. With McDaniel losing, McDaniel, you know, who had a long history of fairly controversial statements, with McDaniel losing, this seat basically becomes a safe Republican reelection bid. Cochran is very likely to win.
And if McDaniel had won, Mississippi would have been in play this year for Democrats, a scenario that establishment Republicans weren't liking. So what does that mean for the big balance of things?
Well, I mean, I think it is an advantage Republicans in the sense that you know, they don't have to spend a whole lot of money in Mississippi. They don't have to worry much about Mississippi. I think if McDaniel had been the candidate, it would have been a much more heavily contested race, a much more expensive race, and a bigger question mark. I think now that's pretty much off the table, unless something else, you know, significant breaks in this race. I mean, I will say, for what it's worth, that Thad Cochran is a really decent human being, but he's also an old fella, and every now and then he says and does things that come across a lot and may still create a challenge for him in the general election, but we'll see. I mean, the other thing, there's other races around the country where the same sort of dynamic worked out. I mean, I believe it's the Colorado governor's race. The establishment candidate was a guy named Bob Beaupre, and the sort of insurgent was a guy named Tom Tancredo, who was a very conservative member of Congress, former member of Congress, who was known basically for being a hardliner on immigration. And in the competitive races in Colorado, there's several next, you know, in the fall, it was going to be a real liability, or assumed it was going to be a real liability, if Tom Tancredo was their standard bearer, because it was going to scare away a lot of Hispanic voters. Well, now you have Bob Beaupre, not nearly such the problem. Again, better for the Republican establishment, worse for the Democrats.
So how do you think that Beaupre won that one? What tipped it his direction?
Oh, well, you know, I think part of what tipped it in his direction is money. In all these cases, you know, it's money. It is the, you know, I'm electable, I'm more reasonable, I'm the guy the party wants. You know, you got a lot of people getting out to vote for you. You got a lot of people organizing on the ground for you. It makes a difference. I mean, the same was also true in Oklahoma. There's a guy named T.W. Shannon who was a candidate for Senate against a guy named Lankford, who is, again, Republican congressman, member of the Republican leadership, endorsed by the Republican establishment. Shannon was endorsed by Sarah Palin and Ted Cruz. But, you know, this is Oklahoma. Being endorsed by a guy from Texas may not be all that helpful to you. And you still have to organize. You still have to get the votes out. This is expected to be a very close race, and in the end it wasn't. Lankford walked away with it. So, you know, sometimes the reason you're part of the establishment is you got a lot of friends who are well-organized and well-connected. You know how the politics works.
Well, people are trying to, you know, I guess, including me, trying to get a handle on whether or not this means the Tea Party is weaker or whether we just shouldn't be reading too much into any of it right now.
Yeah, you know, I was laughing at my reporter pals on Twitter last night because, you know, the races are still coming in and people, oh, 60% of the vote's in and so-and-so's up by 1,000 and so-and-so's down by 1,000. You know, we spend an awful lot of time trying to call this entire political scene like a horse race. You know, so-and-so is ahead by a nose for now, but 5 minutes from now they're going to be someplace different. I try not to look at the national picture that way. The major races have not changed all that much. There's a half dozen or a dozen major national Senate races you need to care about that are going to determine whether Republicans or Democrats control the Senate next year. That is the big banana. And each one of those races is unique and different. The Alaska race with Senator Begich is going to be different than the Arkansas race with Senator Pryor, which is going to be different than the Kentucky race with Senator McConnell. Each race has its own dynamic. There is not really a national story to tell. But then again, those are the kind of things that get me kicked off radio shows, so I try not to say it.
Well, one more that I think is worth mentioning, well, actually a couple more. Democrat Charlie Rangel seems to have
just
held
now.
On to his...
Just
his,
now.
Just in.
They just called it. This just in. Breaking news on your program.
I love it.
The AP has just called that race for Charlie Rangel.
So his opponent conceded?
No.
No.
AP called it. I don't think Espelon has conceded anything yet, but AP has concluded, and we trust them, that there's not enough votes outstanding, still uncounted, to give the race to Espelon, and it's about a 4,000-vote difference, I think. So Charlie Rangel will be, by all measure, returning for his 23rd term and last, I might add. He says it's his last.
It's called the Lion 23rd. Of Harlem, right?
Yeah. Charlie Rangel, you know, he is a total character. He is who he is. I've had my interactions, some pleasant, some unpleasant, with him over the years, and he is a charming fellow. But he doesn't have a whole lot of power in the House anymore. He's no longer the Ways and Means Committee chairman because he had to step down after he was slapped with an ethics violation. So, you know, he's just at this point the third most senior Democrat in the House. Will be second, actually, because John Dingell is stepping down. So he'll be the second most senior Democrat in the House next year.
Well, we're going to zoom out a little bit, talk about a big headline out of the Capitol today that Speaker of the House John Boehner is suing President Obama for overstepping his role as president with his executive orders. What's Boehner's case?
Oh, I'm not sure he has one. I mean, I don't mean any disrespect for Speaker Boehner in this case. I mean, I think this is largely a political statement, not a really significant legal argument. But that said, the case will be that the president is essentially derelict in his duties to enforce the laws as passed by Congress. This is a never-ending back and forth between the two ends of Pennsylvania Avenue. Congress passes laws, and the presidency implements the laws, and Congress is mad. The Republicans in Congress are mad, I should be clear. The Republicans in Congress are mad that Obama essentially has said on several cases, well, I'm going to do this my own way. I'm going to waive certain rules for, say, young immigrants who were brought here illegally by their parents. I won't deport them. He has said, I'm not going to enforce the Defense of Marriage Act, which prohibits federal recognition of gay marriages, stuff like that. They feel that, and they have said over and over again, that we can't trust this president because he doesn't implement laws when we pass them. Now they're going to try and, well, they say they're going to try and file suit alleging that he has essentially broached federal law by not loyally adhering to what was passed in the law. Yeah, I mean, this would be a tough fight. I mean, George W. Bush for years did the same thing. They had these signing statements saying, here's how I interpret the law you've just passed and how I intend to implement it. So I don't know that this is all that new, but it makes for nice theater.
Well, Paul, I have one last very difficult question for you. Yesterday, President Obama was at a Chipotle and he reached over the sneeze guard to point at the food. Should he have done that?
Bad. Bad. Well, then again, I mean, this is the president who's married to Michelle Obama, who's a healthy food connoisseur, and he's going to a Chipotle. So, you know, I figure he's got, you know, more than just hygiene issues to deal with when he gets home.
Well, I think the sneeze guard is sacred.
Well, you know, I do too, but, you know, what can I tell you? He's the president of the United States.
Paul, thanks a lot.
Point his finger at anybody's chili.
Appreciate you joining us.
Yeah, take care, Veronica.
We've been talking to Paul Singer, politics editor for USA Today. He joins us every week at this time to talk about the latest news out of Congress.